and I leaned back in the hot water. My feet began to throb as they came back to life. I knew that naked was wrong, but the hemp stocks seemed indifferent to my nakedness. Letty was gone, and my pajamas and dressing gown with her. Her mother was getting out knives, forks, spoons, little jugs and bigger jugs, carving knives and wooden trenchers, and arranging them about the table. Old Mrs. Hempstock passed me a mug filled with soup from the black pot on the stove. "Get that down, you. Eat you up from the inside first." The soup was rich and warming. I had never drunk soup in the bath before. It was a perfectly new experience. When I finished the mug, I gave it back to her, and in return she passed me a large cake of white soap and a face flannel, and said, "Now get scrubbing. Rub the life and the warmth back into your bones." She sat down in a rocking chair on the other side of the fire and rocked gently, not looking at me. I felt safe. It was as if the essence of grandmotherliness had been condensed into that one place, that one time. I was not at all afraid of Ursula Monkton, whatever she was. Not then. Not there. Young Mrs. Hempstock opened an oven door and took out a pie, its shiny crust brown and glistening, and put it on the window ledge to cool. I dried myself off with a towel they brought me, the fire's heat drying me as much as the towel did. Then Letty Hempstock returned and gave me a voluminous white thing, like a girl's nightdress, but made of white cotton, with long arms and a skirt that draped to the floor and a white cap. I hesitated to put it on until I realized what it was. A nightgown. I had seen pictures of them in books. Wee Willy Winky ran through the town wearing one in every book of nursery rhymes I had ever owned. I slipped into it. The nightcap was too big for me and fell down over my face, and Letty took it away once more. Dinner was wonderful. There was a joint of beef with roast potatoes, golden crisp on the outside and soft and white inside, buttered greens I did not recognize, although I think now that they might have been nettles, roasted carrots all blackened and sweet. I did not think that I liked cooked carrots, so I nearly did not eat one, but I was brave, and I tried it, and I liked it, and was disappointed in boiled carrots for the rest of my childhood. For dessert, there was the pie, stuffed with apples and with swollen raisins and crushed nuts, all topped with a thick yellow custard, creamier and richer than anything I had ever tasted at school or at home. The kitten slept on a cushion beside the fire until the end of the meal, when it joined a fog-colored house cat four times its size in a meal of scraps of meat. While we ate, nothing was said about what had happened to me or why I was there. The Hempstock ladies talked about the farm. There was the door to the milking shed needed a new coat of paint, a cow named Rhiannon who looked to be getting lame in her left hind leg, the path to be cleared on the way that led down to the reservoir. "Is it just the three of you?" I asked. "Aren't there any men?"
"Men?" hooted old Mrs. Hempstock. "I dunno what blessed good a man would be. Nothing a man could do around this farm that I can't do twice as fast and five times as well."
Letty said, "We've had men here sometimes. They come and they go. Right now it's just us." Her mother nodded. "They went off to seek their fate and fortune, mostly the male Hempstocks. There's never any keeping them here when the call comes. They get a distant look in their eyes, and then we've lost them, good and proper. Next chance they get, they're off to towns and even cities, and nothing but an occasional postcard to even show they were here at all." Old Mrs. Hempstock said,
"His parents are coming. They're driving here. They just passed Parson's Elm Tree. The Badgers saw them."
"Is she with them?" I asked. "Ursula Monkton?"
"Her?" said old Mrs. Hempstock, amused. "That thing? Not her."
I thought about it for a moment. "They will make me go back with them, and then she'll lock me in the attic and let my daddy kill me when she gets bored. She said so."
"She may have told you that, Dux," said Letty's mother, "but she ain't going to do it, or anything like it, or my name's not Ginny Hempstock."
I liked the name Ginny, but I did not believe her, and I was not reassured.
Soon the door to the kitchen would open, and my father would shout at me, or he would wait until we got into the car, and he would shout at me then, and they would take me back up the lane to my house, and I would be lost. "Let's see," said Jenny Hempstock. "We could be away when they get here. They could arrive last Tuesday when there's nobody home."
"Out of the question," said the old woman. "Just complicates things, playing with time. We could turn the boy into something else, so they'd never find him. Look how hard they might."
I blinked. Was that even possible? I wanted to be turned into something. The kitten had finished its portion of meat scraps. Indeed, it seemed to have eaten more than the house cat. And now it leapt into my lap and began to wash itself. Jenny Hempstock got up and went out of the room. I wondered where she was going.
"We can't turn him into anything," said Letty, clearing the table of the last of the plates and cutlery. "His parents will get frantic, and if they are being controlled by the flea, she'll just feed the franticness. Next thing you know, we'll have the police dragging the reservoir looking for him. Or worse, the ocean."
The kitten lay down on my lap and curled up, wrapping around itself until it was nothing more than a flattened circlet of fluffy black fur. It closed its vivid blue eyes, the color of an ocean, and it slept, and it purred.
"Well," said old Mrs. Hempstock, "what do you suggest, then?"
Letty thought, pushing her lips together, moving them over to one side. Her head tipped, and I thought she was running through alternatives. Then her face brightened.
"Snip and cut,"
she said. Old Mrs. Hempstock sniffed.
"You're a good girl," she said. "I'm not saying you're not, but snippage, well, you couldn't do that, not yet. You'd have to cut the edges out exactly, sew them back without the seam showing. And what would you cut out? The flea won't let you snip her. She's not in the fabric. She's outside of it."
Jenny Hempstock returned. She was carrying my old dressing gown. "I put it through the mangle," she said, "but it's still damp. That'll make the edges harder to line up. You don't want to do needlework when it's still damp." She put the dressing gown down on the table in front of old Mrs. Hempstock. Then she pulled out from the front pocket of her apron a pair of scissors, black and old, a long needle, and a spool of red thread. "Rowanberry and red thread stop a witch in her speed," I recited. It was something I had read in a book.
"That'll work, and work well," said Letty, "if there was any witches involved in all this. But there's not."
Old Mrs. Hempstock was examining my dressing gown. It was brown and faded, with a sort of sepia tartan across it. It had been a present from my father's parents, my grandparents, several birthdays ago, when it had been comically big on me.
"Probably," she said, as if she was talking to herself, "it would be best if your father was happy for you to stay the night here. But for that to happen, they couldn't be angry with you or even worried."
The black scissors were in her hand, and already snip, snip, snipping then, when I heard a knock on the front door, and Jenny Hempstock got up to answer it. She went into the hall and closed the door behind her. "Don't let them take me," I said to Letty.
"Hush," she said. "I'm working here while Grandmother's snipping. You just be sleepy and at peace. Happy."
I was far from happy, and not in the slightest bit sleepy. Letty leaned across the table, and she took my hand.
"Don't worry," she said.
And with that, the door opened, and my father and my mother were in the kitchen. I wanted to hide, but the kitten shifted reassuringly on my lap, and Letty smiled at me, a reassuring smile.
"We are looking for our son," my father was telling Mrs. Hempstock, "and we have reason to believe."
And even as he was saying that, my mother was striding toward me.
"There he is, darling, we were worried, silly."
"You're in a lot of trouble, young man," said my father.
Snip, snip, snip went the black scissors, and the irregular section of fabric that old Mrs. Hempstock had been cutting fell to the table. My parents froze. They stopped talking, stopped moving. My father's mouth was still open. My mother stood on one leg, as unmoving as if she were a shop window dummy.
What did you do to them?
I was unsure whether or not I ought to be upset.
Ginny Hempstock said, "They're fine. Just a little snipping, then a little sewing, and it'll all be good as gold."
She reached down to the table, pointed to the scrap of faded dressing gown tartan resting upon it. "That's your dad and you in the hallway, and that's the bathtub. She snipped that out. So without any of that, there's no reason for your daddy to be angry with you."
I had not told them about the bathtub. I did not wonder how she knew.
Now the old woman was threading the needle with the red thread. She sighed theatrically.
"Old eyes," she said, "old eyes."
But she licked the tip of the thread and pushed it through the eye of the needle without any apparent difficulty.
"Letty, you'll need to know what his toothbrush looks like," said the old woman.
She began to sew the edges of the dressing gown together with tiny, careful stitches.
"What's your toothbrush look like?" asked Letty, quickly.
It's green," I said, "bright green, a sort of apple-y green. It's not very big, just a green toothbrush, my size." I wasn't describing it very well, I knew. I pictured it in my head, tried to find something more about it that I could describe to set it apart from all other toothbrushes. No good. I imagined it, saw it in my mind's eye with the other toothbrushes in its red and white spotted beaker above the bathroom sink.
"Got it," said Letty. "Nice job."
"Very nearly done here," said old Mrs. Hempstock.
Ginny Hempstock smiled a huge smile, and it lit up her ruddy round face. Old Mrs. Hempstock picked up the scissors and snipped a final time, and a fragment of red thread fell to the tabletop. My mother's foot came down. She took a step, and then she stopped. My father said, Ginny said,
"And it made our Letty so happy that your boy would come here and stay the night. It's a bit old-fashioned here, I'm afraid."
The old woman said,
"We've got an inside lavvy nowadays. I don't know how much more modern anybody could be. Outside lavvies and chamber pots were good enough for me."
"He ate a fine meal," said Ginny to me, "didn't you?"
"There was pie," I told my parents, "for dessert."
My father's brow was creased. He looked confused. Then he put his hand into the pocket of his car coat and pulled out something long and green with toilet paper wrapped around the top.
"You forgot your toothbrush," he said. "Thought you'd want it."
"Now, if he wants to come home, he can come home," my mother was saying to Ginny Hempstock. "He went to stay the night at the Kovacs' house a few months ago, and by 9 he was calling us to come and get him."
Christopher Kovacs was 2 years older and a head taller than me, and he lived with his mother in a large cottage opposite the entrance to our lane by the old green water tower. His mother was divorced. I liked her. She was funny and drove a VW Beetle, the first I had ever seen. Christopher owned many books I had not read and was a member of the Puffin Club. I could read his Puffin books, but only if I went to his house. He would never let me borrow them. There was a bunk bed in Christopher's bedroom, although he was an only child. I was given the bottom bunk the night I stayed there. Once I was in bed, and Christopher Kovacs's mother had said goodnight to us and she turned out the bedroom light and closed the door, he leaned down and began squirting me with a water pistol he had hidden beneath his pillow. I had not known what to do.
"This isn't like when I went to Christopher Kovacs's house," I told my mother, embarrassed. "I like it here."
"What are you wearing?"
She stared at my wee willy winky nightgown in puzzlement. Ginny said, "He had a little accident. He's wearing that while his pajamas are drying."
"Oh, I see," said my mother. "Well, good night, dear. Have a nice time with your new friend."
She peered down at Letty.
"What's your name again, dear?"
"Letty," said Letty Hempstock. "Is it short for Letitia?" asked my mother. "I knew a Letitia when I was at university. Of course, everybody called her Lettice."
Letty just smiled and did not say anything at all. My father put my toothbrush down on the table in front of me. I unwrapped the toilet paper around the head. It was, unmistakably, my green toothbrush. Under his car coat, my father was wearing a clean white shirt.
and no tie. I said, "Thank you."
"So," said my mother, "what time should we be by to pick him up in the morning?"
Ginny smiled even wider.
"Oh, Letty will bring him back to you. We should give them some time to play tomorrow morning. Now, before you go, I baked some scones this afternoon."
And she put some scones into a paper bag, which my mother took politely, and Ginny ushered her and my father out of the door. I held my breath until I heard the sound of the Rover driving away back up the lane.
"What did you do to them?" I asked. And then, "Is this really my toothbrush?"
"That," said old Mrs. Hempstock with satisfaction in her voice, "was a very respectable job of snipping and stitching, if you ask me."
She held up my dressing gown. I could not see where she had removed a piece nor where she had stitched it up. It was seamless, the mend invisible. She passed me the scrap of fabric on the table that she had cut.
"Here's your evening," she said. "You can keep it if you wish, but if I were you, I'd burn it."
The rain pattered against the window, and the wind rattled the window frames. I picked up the jagged-edged sliver of cloth. It was damp. I got up, waking the kitten, who sprang off my lap and vanished into the shadows. I walked over to the fireplace.
"If I burn this," I asked them, "will it have really happened? Will my daddy have pushed me down into the bath? Will I forget it ever happened?"
Ginny Hempstock was no longer smiling. Now she looked concerned.
"What do you want?" she asked.
"I want to remember," I said, "because it happened to me, and I'm still me." I threw the little scrap of cloth onto the fire. There was a crackle, and the cloth smoked. Then it began to burn. I was under the water. I was holding onto my father's tie. I thought he was going to kill me. I screamed. I was lying on the flagstone floor of the Hempstock's kitchen, and I was rolling and screaming. My foot felt like I had trodden barefoot on a burning cinder. The pain was intense. There was another pain, too, deep inside my chest, more distant, not as sharp. A discomfort, not a burning. Ginny was beside me.
"What's wrong?"
"My foot. It's on fire. It hurts so much."
She examined it, then licked her finger, touched it to the hole in my soul from which I had pulled the worm 2 days before. There was a hissing noise, and the pain in my foot began to ease.
"And never seen one of these before," said Ginny Hempstock. "How did you get it?"
"There was a worm inside me," I told her. "That was how it came with us from the place with the orangey sky. In my foot."
And then I looked at Letty, who had crouched beside me and was now holding my hand, and I said,
"I brought it back. It was my fault. I'm sorry."
Old Mrs. Hempstock was the last to reach me. She leaned over, pulled the sole of my foot up and into the light.
"Nasty," she said. "I'm very clever. She left the hole inside you so she could use it again. She could have hidden inside you, if she needed to, used you as a door to go home. No wonder she wanted to keep you in the attic. So, let's strike while the iron's hot," as the soldier said when he entered the laundry.
She prodded the hole in my foot with her finger. It still hurt, but the pain had faded a little. Now it felt like a throbbing headache inside my foot. Something fluttered in my chest like a tiny moth, and then was still. Old Mrs. Hempstock said,
"Can you be brave?"
I did not know. I did not think so. It seemed to me that all I had done so far that night was to run from things. The old woman was holding the needle she had used to sew up my dressing gown, and she grasped it now, not as if she were going to sew anything with it, but as if she were planning to stab me. I pulled my foot back.
"What are you going to do?"
Letty squeezed my hand.
"She's going to make the hole go away," she said. "I'll hold your hand. You don't have to look, not if you don't want to."
"It will hurt," I said. "Stuff and nonsense," said the old woman.
She pulled my foot toward her so the sole was facing her and stabbed the needle down.
Not into my foot, I realized,
but into the hole itself. It did not hurt. Then she twisted the needle and pulled it back toward her. I watched, amazed, as something that glistened, it seemed black at first, then translucent, then reflective, like mercury, was pulled out from the sole of my foot on the end of the needle. I could feel it leaving my leg. The sensation seemed to travel up all the way inside me, up my leg, through my groin and my stomach and into my chest. I felt it leave me with relief. The burning feeling abated, as did my terror. My heart pounded strangely. I watched old Mrs. Hempstock reel the thing in, and I was still unable somehow to entirely make sense of what I was seeing. It was a hole with nothing around it, over 2 feet long, thinner than an earthworm, like the shed skin of a translucent snake. And then she stopped reeling it in.
"Doesn't want to come out," she said. "It's holding on."
There was a coldness in my heart, as if a chip of ice were lodged there. The old woman gave an expert flick of her wrist, and then the glistening thing was dangling from her needle. I found myself thinking now not of mercury, but of the silvery slime trails that snails leave in the garden, and it no longer went into my foot. She let go of my sole, and I pulled the foot back. The tiny round hole had vanished completely, as if it had never been there. Old Mrs. Hempstock cackled with glee.
"Thinks she's so clever," she said. "Leaving her way home inside the boy. Is that clever? I don't think that's clever. I wouldn't give tuppence for the lot of them."
Ginny Hempstock produced an empty jam jar, and the old woman put the bottom of the dangling thing into it, then raised the jar to hold it. At the end, she slipped the glistening, invisible trail off the needle and put the lid on the jam jar with a decisive flick of her bony wrist.
"Ha!"
she said. And again,
"Ha!"
Letty said, "Can I see it?" She took the jam jar, held it up to the light. Inside the jar, the thing had begun lazily to uncurl. It seemed to be floating, as if the jar had been filled with water. It changed color as it caught the light in different ways, sometimes black, sometimes silver. An experiment that I had found in a book of things boys could do, and which I had, of course, done. If you take an egg and blacken it completely with soot from a candle flame, and then put it into a clear container filled with salt water, it will hang in the middle of the water, and it will seem to be silver, a peculiar artificial silver that is only a trick of the light. I thought of that egg, then. Letty seemed fascinated. "You're right. She left her way home inside him. No wonder she didn't want him to leave." I said, "I'm sorry I let go of your hand, Letty." "Oh, hush," she said. "It's always too late for sorries, but I appreciate the sentiment. And next time you'll keep hold of my hand, no matter what she throws at us." I nodded. The ice chip in my heart seemed to warm then and melt, and I began to feel whole and safe once more. "So," said Ginny, "we've got her way home, and we've got the boy safe. That's a good night's work, or I don't know what is."
"But she's got the boy's parents," said old Mrs. Hempstock, "and his sister, and we can't just leave her running around. Remember what happened in Cromwell's day? And before that? When Red Rufus was running around, fleas attract varmints."
She said it as if it were a natural law.
"That can wait until the morrow," said Ginny. "Now, Letty, take the lad and find a room for him to sleep in. He's had a long day."
The black kitten was curled up on the rocking chair beside the fireplace.
"Can I bring the kitten with me?"
"If you don't," said Letty, "she'll just come and find you." Ginny produced 2 candlesticks, the kind with big round handles, each one with a shapeless mound of white wax in it. She lit a wooden taper from the kitchen fire, then transferred the flame from the taper first to one candle wick, and then to the other. She handed one candlestick to me, the other to Letty.
"Don't you have electricity?"
I asked. There were electric lights in the kitchen, big old-fashioned bulbs hanging from the ceiling, their filaments glowing.
"Not in that part of the house," said Letty. "The kitchen's new."
"Sort of."
"Put your hand in front of your candle as you walk, so it doesn't blow out."
She cupped her own hand around the flame as she said this, and I copied her, and I walked behind her. The black kitten followed us, out of the kitchen, through a wooden door painted white, down a step, and into the farmhouse. It was dark, and our candles cast huge shadows, so it looked to me, as we walked, as if everything was moving, pushed and shaped by the shadows, the grandfather clock and the stuffed animals and birds. Were they stuffed? I wondered. Did that owl move? Or was it just the flickering candle flame that made me think that it had turned its head as we passed? The hall table, the chairs, all of them moved in the candlelight and all of them stayed perfectly still. We went up a set of stairs and then up some steps and we passed an open window. Moonlight spilled onto the stairs brighter than our candle flames. I glanced up through the window and I saw the full moon. The cloudless sky was splashed with stars beyond all counting.
"That's the moon," I said.
"Gran likes it like that," said Letty Hempstock. "But it was a crescent moon yesterday, and now it's full, and it was raining. It is raining, but now it's not."
"Gran always likes the full moon to shine on this side of the house. She says it's restful and it reminds her of when she was a girl," said Letty. "And it means you don't trip on the stairs."
The kitten followed us up the stairs in a sequence of bounces. It made me smile. At the top of the house was Letty's room, and beside it, another room. And it was this room that we entered. A fire blazed in the hearth, illuminating the room with oranges and yellows. The room was warm and inviting. The bed had posts at each corner, and it had its own curtains. I had seen something like it in cartoons, but never in real life.
"There's clothes already set out for you to put on in the morning," said Letty. "I'll be asleep in the room next door. If you want me, just shout or knock if you need anything, and I'll come in. Gran said for you to use the inside lavatory, but it's a long way through the house, and you might get lost, so if you need to do your business, there's a chamber pot under the bed, same as there's always been."
I blew out my candle, which left the room illuminated by the fire in the hearth, and I pushed through the curtains and climbed up into the bed. The room was warm, but the sheets were cold as I got inside them. The bed shook as something landed on it, and then small feet padded up the blankets, and a warm, furry presence pushed itself into my face, and the kitten began, softly, to purr. There was still a monster in my house, and in a fragment of time that had perhaps been snipped out of reality, my father had pushed me down into the water of the bath and tried, perhaps, to drown me. I had run for miles through the dark. I had seen my father kissing and touching the thing that called itself Ursula Monkton. The dread had not left my soul. But there was a kitten on my pillow, and it was purring in my face and vibrating gently with every purr. And very soon, I slept.
Chapter 10. I had strange dreams in the house that night. I woke myself in the darkness, and I knew only that a dream had scared me so badly that I had to wake up or die. And yet, try as I might, I could not remember what I had dreamed. The dream was haunting me, standing behind me, present and yet invisible, like the back of my head, simultaneously there and not there. I missed my father, and I missed my mother, and I missed my bed in my house only a mile or so away. I missed yesterday, before Ursula Monkton, before my father's anger, before the bathtub. I wanted that yesterday back again, and I wanted it so badly. I tried to pull the dream that had upset me so to the front of my mind, but it would not come. There had been betrayal in it, I knew, and loss, and time. The dream had left me scared to go back to sleep. The fireplace was almost dark now, with only the deep red glow of embers in the hearth to to mark that it had once been burning, once had given light. I climbed down from the four-poster bed and felt beneath it until I found the heavy china chamber pot. I hitched up my nightgown, and I used it. Then I walked to the window and looked out. The moon was still full, but now it was low in the sky, and a dark orange, what my mother called a harvest moon. But things were harvested in autumn, I knew, not in spring. In the orange moonlight, I could see an old woman. I was almost certain it was old Mrs. Hempstock, although it was hard to see her face properly, walking up and down. She had a big long stick she was leaning on as she walked, like a staff. She reminded me of the soldiers I had seen on a trip to London outside Buckingham Palace as they marched backwards and forwards on parade. I watched her, and I was comforted. I climbed back into my bed in the dark, lay my head on the empty pillow, and thought, I'll never go back to sleep. Not now. And then I opened my eyes and saw that it was morning. There were clothes I had never seen before on a chair by the bed. There were two china jugs of water, one steaming hot, one cold, beside a white china bowl that I realized was a hand basin, set into a small wooden table. The fluffy black kitten had returned to the foot of the bed. It opened its eyes as I got up. They were a vivid blue-green, unnatural and odd like the sea in summer, and it mewed a high-pitched questioning noise. I stroked it. Then I got out of bed. I mixed the hot water and the cold in the basin, and I washed my face and my hands. I cleaned my teeth with the cold water. There was no toothpaste, but there was a small round tin box on which was written, Max Melton's Remarkably Efficacious Tooth Powder, in old-fashioned letters. I put some of the white powder on my green toothbrush and cleaned my teeth with it. It tasted minty and lemony in my mouth. I examined the clothes that had been left out for me. They were unlike anything I had ever worn before. There were no underpants. There was a white undershirt, with no buttons, but with a long shirt tail. There were brown trousers that stopped at the knees, a pair of long white stockings, and a chestnut-colored jacket with a V cut into the back like a swallow's tail. The light brown socks were more like stockings. I put the clothes on as best I could, wishing there were zips or clasps, rather than hooks and buttons and stiff, unyielding buttonholes. The shoes had silver buckles in the front, but the shoes were too big and did not fit me, so I went out of the room in my stockinged feet, and the kitten followed me. To reach my room the night before, I had walked upstairs, and at the top of the stairs, turned left. Now I turned right and walked past Letty's bedroom. The door was ajar, the room was empty, and made for the stairs. But the stairs were not where I remembered them. The corridor ended in a blank wall and a window that looked out over woodland and fields. The black kitten with the blue-green eyes mewed loudly as if to attract my attention and turned back down the corridor in a self-important strut, tail held high. It led me down the hall, round a corner and down a passage I had never seen before, to a staircase. The kitten bounced amiably down the stairs, and I followed. Jinny Hempstock was standing at the foot of the stairs. "You slept long and well," she said. "We've already milked the cows. Your breakfast is on the table, and there's a saucer of cream by the fireplace for your friend." "Where's Letty, Mrs. Hempstock?" "Off on an errand, getting stuff she may need. It has to go, the thing at your house, or there will be trouble, and worse will follow. She's already bound it once, and it slipped the bounds, so she needs to send it home." "I just want Ursula Monckton to go away," I said. "I hate her." Jinny Hempstock put out a finger, ran it across my jacket. "It's not what anyone else hereabouts is wearing these days," she said, "but my man put a little glamour on it, so it's not as if anyone will notice. You can walk around in it all you want, and not a soul will think there's anything odd about it." "No shoes?" "They didn't fit."
I'll leave something that will fit you by the back door, then.
Thank you.
She said, I don't hate her. She does what she does, according to her nature. She was asleep, she woke up, she's trying to give everyone what they want. She hasn't given me anything I want. She says she wants to put me in the attic. That's as maybe. You were her way here, and it's a dangerous thing to be a door. She tapped my chest above my heart with her forefinger. And she was better off where she was. We would have sent her home safely, done it before for her kind 12 times. But she's headstrong, that one. No teaching them. Right. Your breakfast is on the table. I'll be up in the 9-acre field if anyone needs me. There was a bowl of porridge on the kitchen table, and beside it a saucer with a lump of golden honeycomb on it and a jug of rich yellow cream. I spooned up a lump of the honeycomb and mixed it into the thick porridge, and then I poured in the cream. There was toast, too, cooked beneath the grill as my father cooked it with homemade blackberry jam. There was the best cup of tea I have ever drunk. By the fireplace, the kitten lapped at a saucer of creamy milk and purred so loudly I could hear it across the room. I wished I could purr, too. I would have purred then. Letty came in, carrying a shopping bag, the old-fashioned kind you never seem to see anymore. Elderly women used to carry them to the shops, big woven bags that were almost baskets, raffia work outside and lined with cloth, with rope handles. This basket was almost full. Her cheek had been scratched and had bled, although the blood had dried. She looked miserable.
Hello,
I said.
Well, she said, let me tell you, if you think that was fun, that wasn't any fun, not one bit. Mandrakes are so loud when you pull them up, and I didn't have earplugs, and once I got it, I had to swap it for a shadow bottle, an old-fashioned one with lots of shadows dissolved in vinegar.
She buttered some toast, then crushed a lump of golden honeycomb onto it, and started munching.
And that was just to get me to the bazaar, and they aren't even meant to be open yet.
But I got most of what I needed there.
Can I look?
If you want to. I looked into the basket. It was filled with broken toys. Dolls' eyes and heads and hands, cars with no wheels, chipped cat's-eye glass marbles. Letty reached up and took down the jam jar from the window ledge. Inside it, the silvery, translucent wormhole shifted and twisted and spiraled and turned. Letty dropped the jam jar into the shopping bag with the broken toys. The kitten slept and ignored us entirely.
Letty said, you don't have to come with for this bit. You can stay here while I go and talk to her.
I thought about it. I'd feel safer with you, I told her. She did not look happy at this. She said, let's go down to the ocean. The kitten opened its 2 green and blue eyes and stared at us disinterestedly as we left. There was a pair of black leather boots, like riding boots, waiting for me by the back door. They looked old, but well cared for, and were just my size. I put them on, although I felt more comfortable in sandals. Together, Letty and I walked down to her ocean, by which I mean the pond. We sat on the old bench and looked at the placid brown surface of the pond and the lily pads and the scum of duckweed by the water's edge.
You Hempstocks aren't people, I said.
Are too.
I shook my head. I bet you don't actually even look like that, I said. Not really. Letty shrugged. Nobody actually looks like what they really are on the inside. You don't?
I don't. People are much more complicated than that. It's true of everybody.
I said, are you a monster? Like Ursula Monkton?
Letty threw a pebble into the pond.
I don't think so, she said.
Monsters come in all shapes and sizes. Some of them are things people are scared of. Some of them are things that look like things people used to be scared of a long time ago. Sometimes monsters are things people should be scared of, but they aren't.
I said, people should be scared of Ursula Monkton.
Perhaps.
What do you think Ursula Monkton is scared of?
Dunno.
Why do you think she's scared of anything? She's a grown-up, isn't she? Grown-ups and monsters aren't scared of things.
Oh, monsters are scared, said Letty. That's why they're monsters. And as for grown-ups...
She stopped talking, rubbed her freckled nose with a finger. Then, I'm going to tell you something important. Grown-ups don't look like grown-ups on the inside either. Outside, they're big and thoughtless, and they always know what they're doing. Inside, they look just like they always have, like they did when they were your age. The truth is, there aren't any grown-ups, not one, in the whole wide world. She thought for a moment. Then she smiled. Oh, except for Granny, of course. We sat there, side by side on the old wooden bench, not saying anything. I thought about adults. I wondered if that was true, if they were all really children wrapped in adult bodies, like children's books hidden in the middle of dull, long adult books, the kind with no pictures or conversations. I love my ocean, Letty said, and I knew our time by the pond was done. It's just pretending, though, I told her, feeling like I was letting childhood down by admitting it. Your pond is not an ocean. It can't be. Oceans are bigger than seas. Your pond is just a pond. It's as big as it needs to be, said Letty Hempstock, nettled. She sighed.
We better get on with sending Ursula what's-her-name back where she came from.
Then she said, I do know what she's scared of. And you know what? I'm scared of them too. The kitten was nowhere to be seen when we returned to the kitchen, although the fog-colored cat was sitting on a windowsill staring out at the world. The breakfast things had all been tidied up and put away, and my red pajamas and my dressing gown, neatly folded, were waiting for me on the table in a large brown paper bag, along with my green toothbrush. You won't let her get me, will you? I asked Letty. She shook her head, and together we walked up the winding flinty lane that led to my house and to the thing who called herself Ursula Monkton. I carried the brown paper bag with my nightwear in it, and Letty carried her, too big for her, raffia shopping bag filled with broken toys, which she had obtained in exchange for a mandrake that screamed and shadows dissolved in vinegar. Children, as I have said, use backways and hidden paths, while adults take roads and official paths. We went off the road, took a shortcut that Letty knew that took us through some fields, then into the extensive abandoned gardens of a rich man's crumbling house, and then back onto the lane again. We came out just before the place where I had gone over the metal fence. Letty sniffed the air.
No varmints yet, she said. That's good.
What are varmints? She said only, you'll know 'em when you see 'em, and I hope you'll never see 'em. Are we going to sneak in? Why would we do that? We'll go up the drive and through the front door, like gentry. We started up the drive. I said, are you going to make a spell and send her away?
We don't do spells, she said.
She sounded a little disappointed to admit it.
We'll do recipes sometimes, but no spells or cantrips. Gran doesn't hold with none of that. She says it's common.
So what's the stuff in the shopping bag for, then?
It's to stop things travelling when you don't want them to. Mark boundaries.
In the morning sunlight, my house looked so welcoming and so friendly, with its warm red bricks and red tile roof. Letty reached into the shopping bag. She took a marble from it, pushed it into the still damp soil. Then, instead of going into the house, she turned left, walking the edge of the property. By Mr. Wallery's vegetable patch, we stopped and she took something else from her shopping bag, a headless, legless, pink doll body with badly chewed hands. She buried it beside the pea plants. We picked some pea pods, opened them, and ate the peas inside. Peas baffled me. I could not understand why grown-ups would take things that tasted so good when they were freshly picked and raw and put them in tin cans and make them revolting. Letty placed a toy giraffe, the small plastic kind you would find in a children's zoo or a Noah's Ark, in the coal shed beneath a large lump of coal. The coal shed smelled of damp and blackness and of old, crushed forests. Will these things make her go away? No. Then what are they for? To stop her going away. But we want her to go away. No, we want her to go home. I stared at her. At her short, brownish-red hair, her snub nose, her freckles. She looked 3 or 4 years older than me. She might have been 3 or 4,000 years older, or 1,000 times older again. I would have trusted her to the gates of hell and back, but still. "I wish you'd explain properly," I said. "You talk in mysteries all the time." I was not scared, though, and I could not have told you why I was not scared. I trusted Letty, just as I had trusted her when we had gone in search of the flapping thing beneath the orange sky. I believed in her, and that meant I would come to no harm while I was with her. I knew it in the way I knew that grass was green, that roses had sharp woody thorns, that breakfast cereal was sweet. We went into my house through the front door. It was not locked. Unless we went away on holidays, I do not ever remember it being locked. And we went inside. My sister was practicing the piano in the front room. We went in. She heard the noise, stopped playing chopsticks, and turned around. She looked at me curiously. "What happened last night?" she asked. "I thought you were in trouble, but then Mummy and Daddy came back, and you were just staying with your friends. Why would they say you were sleeping at your friends'? You don't have any friends." She noticed Letty Hempstock then. "Who's this?" "My friend," I told her. "Where's the horrible monster?" "Don't call her that," said my sister. "She's nice. She's having a lie down." My sister did not say anything about my strange clothes. Letty Hempstock took a broken xylophone from her shopping bag and dropped it onto the scree of toys that had accumulated between the piano and the blue toy box with the detached lid. "There," she said, "now it's time to go and say hello." The first faint stirrings of fear inside my chest, inside my mind. "Go up to her room, you mean?"
"Yep."
"What's she doing up there?"
"Doing things to people's lives," said Letty. "Only local people so far. She finds what they think they need, and she tries to give it to them. She's doing it to make the world into something she'll be happier in, somewhere more comfortable for her, somewhere cleaner. And she doesn't care so much about giving them money, not anymore. Now what she cares about more is people hurting." As we went up the stairs, Letty placed something on each step. A clear glass marble with a twist of green inside it, one of the little metal objects we called knuckle bones, a bead, a pair of bright blue doll's eyes connected at the back with white plastic to make them open or close, a small red and white horseshoe magnet, a black pebble, a badge, the kind that came attached to birthday cards with "I am 7" on it, a book of matches, a plastic ladybird with a black magnet in the base, a toy car half squashed, its wheels gone, and last of all, a lead soldier. It was missing a leg. We were at the top of the stairs. The bedroom door was closed. Letty said, "She won't put you in the attic." Then, without knocking, she opened the door, and she went into the bedroom that had once been mine, and, reluctantly, I followed. Ursula Monckton was lying on the bed with her eyes closed. She was the first adult woman who was not my mother that I had seen naked, and I glanced at her curiously. But the room was more interesting to me than she was. It was my old bedroom, but it wasn't. Not anymore. There was the little yellow hand basin, just my size, and the walls were still robin's egg blue, as they had been when it was mine,
but now strips of cloth hung from the ceiling, grey, ragged cloth strips like bandages, some only a foot long, others dangling almost all the way to the floor. The window was open, and the wind rustled and pushed them so they swayed greyly, and it seemed as if perhaps the room was moving, like a tent or a ship at sea.
"You have to go now," said Letty.
Ursula Monkton sat up on the bed, and then she opened her eyes, which were now the same grey as the hanging cloths. She said, in a voice that still sounded half asleep,
"I wondered what I would have to do to bring you both here. And look, you came."
"You didn't bring us," Letty said. "We came because we wanted to, and I came to give you one last chance to go."
"I'm not going anywhere,"
said Ursula Monkton, and she sounded petulant, like a very small child who wanted something.
"I've only just got here. I have a house now. I have pets. His father is just the sweetest thing. I'm making people happy. There is nothing like me anywhere in this whole world. I was looking just now when you came in. I'm the only one there is. They can't defend themselves. They don't know how. So this is the best place in the whole of creation."
She smiled at us both brightly. She really was pretty for a grown-up, but when you were 7, beauty is an abstraction, not an imperative. I wonder what I would have done if she had smiled at me like that now, whether I would have handed my mind or my heart or my identity to her for the asking, as my father did.
"You think this world's like that," said Letty. "You think it's easy, but it ain't."
"Of course it is.
What are you saying? That you and your family will defend this world against me? You're the only one who ever leaves the borders of your farm, and you tried to bind me without knowing my name. Your mother wouldn't have been that foolish. I'm not scared of you, little girl."
Letty reached deep into the shopping bag. She pulled out the jam jar with the translucent wormhole inside and held it out.
"Here's your way back," she said. "I'm being kind, and I'm being nice. Trust me. Take it. I don't think you can get any further to home than the place we met you with the orange sky, but that's far enough. I can't get you from there to where you came from in the first place. I asked Gran, and she says it isn't even there anymore. But once you're back, we can find a place for you, somewhere similar. Somewhere you'll be happy. Somewhere you'll be safe."
Ursula Monkton got off the bed. She stood up and looked down at us. There were no lightnings wreathing her, not any longer, but she was scarier standing naked in that bedroom than she had been, floating in the storm. She was an adult, no, more than an adult. She was old, and I have never felt more like a child.
"I'm so happy here," she said. "So very, very happy here."
And then she said, almost regretfully, "You're not." I heard a sound, a soft, raggedy flapping sound. The grey cloths began to detach themselves from the ceiling one by one. They fell, but not in a straight line. They fell toward us from all over the room as if we were magnets pulling them toward our bodies. The first strip of grey cloth landed on the back of my left hand, and it stuck there. I reached out my right hand and grabbed it, and I pulled the cloth off. It adhered for a moment, and as it pulled off, it made a sucking noise. There was a discolored patch on the back of my left hand where the cloth had been, and it was as red as if I had been sucking on it for a long, long time, longer and harder than I ever had in real life, and it was beaded with blood. There were pinpricks of red wetness that smeared as I touched it, and then a long bandage cloth began to attach itself to my legs, and I moved away as a cloth landed on my face and my forehead, and another wrapped itself over my eyes, blinding me. So I pulled at the cloth on my eyes, but now another cloth circled my wrists, bound them together, and my arms were wrapped and bound to my body, and I stumbled and fell to the floor. If I pulled against the cloths, they hurt me. My world was grey. I gave up then, I lay there and did not move, concentrated only on breathing through the space the cloth strips had left for my nose. They held me, and they felt alive. I lay on the carpet and I listened. There was nothing else I could do. Ursula said, "I need the boy safe. I promised I'd keep him in the attic, so the attic it shall be. But you, little farm girl, what shall I do with you? Something appropriate. Perhaps I ought to turn you inside out, so your heart and brains and flesh are all naked and exposed on the outside, and the skin sides inside. Then I'll keep you wrapped up in my room here, with your eyes staring forever at the darkness inside yourself. I can do that." "No," said Letty. She sounded sad, I thought.
Or if Fluffy proved particularly intelligent, we would be the miller's son and Puss in Boots. The kitten slept on my pillow, and it even waited for me to come home from school, sitting on the driveway in front of my house by the fence, until a month later it was run over by the taxi that brought the opal miner to stay at my house. I was not there when it happened. I got home from school that day, and my kitten was not waiting to meet me. In the kitchen was a tall, rangy man with tanned skin and a checked shirt. He was drinking coffee at the kitchen table. I could smell it. In those days, all coffee was instant coffee, a bitter dark brown powder that came out of a jar. "I'm afraid I had a little accident arriving here," he told me cheerfully, "but not to worry." His accent was clipped, unfamiliar. It was the first South African accent I had heard. He, too, had a cardboard box on the table in front of him. "The black kitten, was he yours?" he asked. "It's called Fluffy," I said. "Yeah, like I said, accident coming here. Not to worry. Disposed of the corpse. Don't have to trouble yourself. Dealt with the matter. Open the box."
"What?"
He pointed to the box. "Open it," he said. The opal miner was a tall man. He wore jeans and checked shirts every time I saw him, except the last. He had a thick chain of pale gold around his neck. That was gone the last time I saw him, too. I did not want to open his box. I wanted to go off on my own. I wanted to cry for my kitten, but I could not do that if anyone else was there and watching me. I wanted to mourn. I wanted to bury my friend at the bottom of the garden, past the green grass fairy ring, into the rhododendron bush cave, back past the heap of grass cuttings, where nobody ever went but me. The box moved. "Bought it for you," said the man. "Always pay my debts." I reached out, lifted the top flap of the box, wondering if this was a joke, if my kitten would be in there. Instead, a ginger face stared up at me truculently. The opal miner took the cat out of the box. He was a huge, ginger-striped tomcat, missing half an ear. He glared at me angrily. This cat had not liked being put in a box. He was not used to boxes. I reached out to stroke his head, feeling unfaithful to the memory of my kitten, but he pulled back so I could not touch him, and he hissed at me, then stalked off to a far corner of the room where he sat and looked and hated. "There you go, kit for a cat," said the opal miner, and he ruffled my hair with his leathery hand. Then he went out into the hall, leaving me in the kitchen with the cat that was not my kitten. The man put his head back through the door. "He's called Monster," he said. It felt like a bad joke. I propped open the kitchen door so the cat could get out. Then I went up to the bedroom and lay on my bed and cried for dead Fluffy. When my parents got home that evening, I do not think my kitten was even mentioned. Monster lived with us for a week or more. I put cat food in the bowl for him in the morning and again at night, as I had for my kitten. He would sit by the back door until I, or someone else, let him out. We saw him in the garden, slipping from bush to bush, or in trees, or in the undergrowth. We could trace his movements by the dead blue tits and thrushes we would find in the garden, but we saw him rarely. I missed Fluffy. I knew you could not simply replace something alive, but I dared not grumble to my parents about it.
They would have been baffled at my upset. After all, if my kitten had been killed, it had also been replaced. The damage had been made up. It all came back. And even as it all came back, I knew it would not be for long. All the things